This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Today on the show, we are going to pull on our boots and celebrate the best parts of mud season with Vermont's state geologist and the Green Mountain Club's field director. We're compiling a list of ways to enjoy this time of year, especially for those of us who struggle a bit with it. You can email us with your favorite mud season activities or hiking trails throughout this hour at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. And we'll put them up on our website, vermontpublic.org, after today's show. But first, we bring you a story from Vergennes in Addison County. Plans are coming together there for a new juvenile detention center called the Green Mountain Youth Campus. Teenagers who have been charged with crimes in Vermont will be sent there. Joining us with an update on the facility is VT Digger reporter Peter DeOria. Peter, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So tell us the basics of this facility. Who exactly is it for?
Yeah, so as you just said, this is for what the state and advocates sort of deem or term justice-involved youth, which is effectively young people who have been charged with a crime. The question of exactly who it's for has been a little vague as the plans are kind of coming together. The current design for this facility is it's going to have sort of two wings. One is like a short-term sort of stabilization wing, and the other is like a longer-term residential wing. And the idea is that these kids, ages, 12 to 18, are going to be able to get treatment, like crisis stabilization, therapeutic services, et cetera, et cetera.
And to be clear, it's locked, right? Kids can't just come and go?
Yep, it is locked, or it will be locked. And it is exclusive. It's not, it's exclusively for youth who are involved in the criminal justice system.
Okay. And does anything else like this exist in the state right now?
No. The closest thing that we had to this was Woodside, the state's only juvenile detention facility, which closed in 2020. This is sort of intended to kind of fill, to some degree, the void left by Woodside.
And that was in Colchester, right? Woodside?
Essex.
Essex,
I believe.
Excuse me.
I'm going to get corrected on this. I hope not. That was, I believe, a 30-bed facility and closed amid these like swirling allegations of pretty shocking conditions, pretty like horrific abuse that happened to the kids there. Mm. And so the state is saying, we need a facility that's going to be able to replace this to be able to like house these kids who are involved in the juvenile justice or the criminal justice system, juvenile justice system. But we're trying, what they're saying, we've learned, we're really, really cognizant of kind of what happened. And we're trying to make sure that that does not happen again at this Vergennes facility.
Hmm. So right now, where do 12 to 17 year olds who are charged with crimes go? They're not going to prisons, are they?
So some of them are ending up in prisons. Huh. That is probably a little more rare. They're going sometimes, especially if it's a sort of a crisis stabilization situation, they're ending up in the emergency rooms. They're ending up in like crisis beds.
Okay.
They're often sometimes they go out of state and just like far-flung, Vermont has kids in Florida, DC have kids in Florida, facilities in, I think, New Hampshire, just various places in the country. And there's part of, I think, the goal here is to sort of make, have kids in Vermont be able to have like a little more visibility as to what's going on, have them in like an appropriate treatment center.
Hmm. So let's go back to, this proposed site in Vergennes. What's currently going on at the site? What does the area look like?
I'll be very honest. I have not visited. My understanding is it's undeveloped. It's state land. This facility that would need to be stood up would involve like quite a bit of just all new construction on this land.
Okay. And do we know yet who's going to be building and administering the facility?
We are not 100% to the, my knowledge at this point, and this could have changed in the past, I don't know, week or few days or something, there's not an operator selected yet. There is an operator who's sort of acting as a consultant, sort of helping out with the design at this stage. It's not, to my knowledge, clear. I believe the state wants them to run this, and I don't know if it's clear that they're going to run this. It's a company called Sentinel LLC. Some of the folks involved in Sentinel have been involved in some other sort of youth treatment residential facilities, VPI, Vermont School for Girls, New England School for Girls. And, you know, the state is sort of aware of this entity and like where the people and like has some relationship and some degree of trust with them.
If you're just joining us, we are discussing the new juvenile detention center called the Green Mountain Youth Campus, which will be opening in Vergennes with Peter DeOria of VT Digger. Peter, recently you reported that the facility is not going to include space for older teens, so 18 and 19 year olds. Why not?
Yeah, so this goes back a little bit, I think, to what I said about, you know, some of the specifics about this place not exactly being ironed out. The initial design was that it would have 14 beds and be for like 12 to 18. There was a proposal that we reported on from the state to expand the number of beds, add a sort of like a whole new wing to 22 beds, kind of with the goal of getting, you know, allowing this place to serve like older kids. And this was, when we reported this, this sort of, as I understand it, came as a bit of a surprise to Vergennes, and they had not heard that the state was planning to, you know, build more than what they had originally said, which was 14 beds. And the state sort of backed away from that and said, we're actually going to go back to like the original, just, you know, 14 bed plan, 12 to 18. It kind of dovetails with, this initiative called Raise the Age, through which the, it's a law that was passed some years ago where the state is sort of trying to bring more, older teens into family court rather than criminal court. The idea is that kids' brains are still developing. You know, their choices that they're making are maybe not as like fully informed by like a, I guess, developed brain as like a, you know, 30 or 25 year old.
And when you say kids, we're talking here about 18 and 19 year olds.
Yes. Yeah.
Including them in family court.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the first stage of that, bringing 18 year olds, this is very complicated and there's like a lot of like sort of exceptions to it. But for like lower level crimes now, if you're 18, you are likely not going to go to criminal court and your case is going to stay in family court. The law was scheduled to sort of expand that jurisdiction to 19-year-olds. And this has been repeatedly delayed by the legislature at the request of the governor. And the governor is now requesting, asking that like the whole, you know, for a total repeal rather than just a delay.
Why does he want to see it repealed?
There has been a lot of concern in Vermont about public safety. And there's been a lot of concern, I think, specifically about younger offenders and younger people getting involved in the criminal justice system, maybe around drugs, like violent crimes. And I think this has been like a big sort of talking point from the governor that we need to sort of tighten down as far as like public safety.
Hmm. And the there's a date coming up. It's the beginning of April when Raise the Age is supposed to kick in, or this new level of this new iteration of Raise the Age. As you said, it's a rather complicated law with lots of different tiers to it. So lawmakers are working right now to figure out whether they're going to stick to that deadline or not.
It seems fairly I don't want to like predict something because this could turn around on me, but it seems fairly clear that it is, in fact, going to get delayed once more for maybe, I don't know, fourth or fifth time. I mean, it's almost like this ritual thing over the past few years of, you know, kicking this can down the road, of bringing 19-year-olds into the sort of family court rather than criminal court.
Right.
So it seems that they are headed on this path to, again, delay it.
Okay. So you had mentioned that there was some pushback from folks in the Vergence community when they heard that there was a plan to make this facility larger than the originally planned 14 beds. And we've seen other juvenile detention centers, plans for them, fail in Vermont before. I'm thinking of Newport, where there was a lot of community pushback to creating one of these centers there, and that plan never came to fruition. In its conversations and dealings with the Vergence community, has the state offered up any, I don't know if concessions is the right word here, but ways in which they will support that community because they will be housing this facility?
I think the state has offered a lot of support to the community, and I think exactly what that looks like is not yet clear. One of the things I heard from folks in Vergence when I was reporting this story was that they, because the sort of final plans had not been ironed out exactly, like they weren't even sure exactly like how they should be negotiating with the state. Vergence has this kind of wish list of items that they're looking for. I also don't know if concessions is the right word, but like some sort of exchange, you know, benefits in exchange for maybe hosting this facility. You know, they're looking for the transfer of state land for affordable housing. They're looking for like infrastructure, public safety investments, you know, tax revenue or pilot payments in lieu of taxes. Like restoration work on historic buildings. But I think because it's not clear, you know, so much of the actual design, I don't know about so much, some of the details of the actual design of this facility are not yet ironed out. It's not exactly clear what they're going to kind of formally ask for or what's going to even, you know, be granted by the state. Hmm.
And I'm not sure I misspoke, but I'm worried that I did when I was discussing the previously planned juvenile detention center. It was going to be in Newbury.
That's correct.
Not Newport.
Yeah.
I'm worried. Mm-hmm. I said Newport. So there's still seems like there's a lot up in the air around this detention center. Do we have any idea about a timeline right now? When can we see it open, Peter?
I don't know. I think the initial goal, I believe, was 2026.
Okay.
It's March of 2025. I don't think that we're maybe going to get that. And I mean, this has been, you know, as you mentioned, there is a facility in Newbury. They'd selected that site. This is sort of like the successor. Like they initially tried to do it in Newbury. The community was very, very upset about it. There's a huge amount of pushback. There's litigation. And the state eventually said, you know, we don't like we're not trying to do this anymore. We don't want to like make enemies of or we don't want to be somewhere where we're not wanted. And so they shifted their focus to Vergence. All that is to say that there have been delays. This has been kind of pushed back repeatedly. You know, Woodside closed in 2020. I don't even, you know, there were plans, I think, even before it closed to sort of build something of like a successor facility or like a more kind of therapeutic successor facility. And I had those plans actually with the timeline that they laid out at that point come into fruition. I think it would be open by now. Hmm. So who knows?
VT Digger reporter Peter Doria, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You can find Peter's reporting on vtdigger.com. Coming up, our landscape is shedding its white winter coat and heading toward spring. But first, we got to survive mud season. We'll talk with Vermont's state geologist about our region's unique terrain in just a minute. This is Vermont Edition. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lefrak. I've got to be honest with you all. I really struggle with mud season. Once the time change happens, I am ready for it to be spring already. I don't want to wear my coat. I don't want to wear my boots. And when it's muddy and cold and the trees are still bare, I just find myself getting really antsy and frankly, a little annoyed. But I am learning. Like the Grinch, my heart is slowly expanding to enjoy mud season. I mean, there's sugaring to do and extra hours of daylight to enjoy. We want to hear how you survive or thrive during this time of year. What keeps you going through mud season? Or what do you love about it? We're going to be compiling a list and publishing it on our website after today's show. So you can send your mud season suggestions to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org or call in and tell us about it at 800-639-2211. Now, our region's geology is a driving force behind mud season's signature characteristics. Here to tell us more about that is Ben DeYoung. He's Vermont's state geologist, where he conducts research about Vermont's geology and mineral resources and topography to learn more about how they could affect the state's infrastructure, groundwater resources, and more. Ben, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, you know, in some towns, most of the roads are paved. You can usually get through mud season unscathed. But in others, the majority of roads are dirt, a.k.a. mud. Now, you live in Waterbury. Is that right?
You got it.
Okay. So that's like half dirt roads. Have you had any trouble navigating yet?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I live on a dirt road, and I am living this reality right alongside many of your listeners. And thriving and surviving at the same time, just like you suggested.
Do you have the right kind of car for it, the right vehicle? Are you set up well?
One of them we leave parked, honestly, for like 2 weeks. Mm. And that's just sort of how it is. And right now, our buses are not coming up this way. The road crews advised the school district that they just not use the road. So the morning routine is a little bit shifted, but we're making it work.
Mm. Well, ahead of today's show, we reached out to a number of road foremen in different parts of the state to see if they could call into the show. But for the ones who are seeing that mud out there, this time of year is just way too busy for them. Up in Johnson, it was an all hands on deck situation. And in Warren, we heard that they spent the entire night grading the road and are just now finding some time to get some shut-eye. So we're very thankful to all the folks working on the roads right now. Ben, how exactly does Vermont's geology contribute to the muddiness of mud season?
That's a great question, actually. And I think the key word there is mud. And we use the term a lot, right? But if you're a geologist, you like to specify what exactly that is. So mud really is silt and clay. That's what our muddy roads, unfortunately, consist a little bit too much of. And the soils in our state, and for better or for worse, much of the available aggregate we have to work with in the state are derived from our bedrock, which is predominantly, you guessed it, it's fine silt and clay. And it originated in a shallow sea that existed to our east hundreds of millions of years ago. And those silts and clays were turned into rock and then shoved up as our green mountains in a big mountain building event. And so, you know, ultimately we can thank our sort of silty, clay marine origins for our muddy conditions today. And I think it's safe to say that if Vermont was built on all sandstone and we had abundant, well-drained sand and gravel, we might see very different road conditions each March.
Mm. So are you saying that folks in New Hampshire or Quebec, some of our neighbors, are seeing very different conditions than we are because of the way that their land is constructed?
They certainly have their mud season. I sometimes do this just to compare, but if you pull up the newsreels, you'll see some mud season stories over in New Hampshire as well. I think that the persistence of our mud season is a little bit worse, and perhaps the severity of it as well.
Mm. So yesterday, Ben, on Vermont Public, we aired what I think was our first flood warning of the year. And I know for me and a lot of other folks who work here, and probably many who are listening, it brought back a lot of tough memories of last year and the year before and all the terrible flooding and landslides that occurred in our region. What role does your work, your office, play in the state's flood resilience efforts?
Yeah, it's actually, it's a really fitting question because as a geologist, when I start seeing the soupy roads, that's actually right when I start getting ready for phone calls and emails regarding floods and unfortunately now landslide hazards as well. We're very fortunate to work with a sister division, the Watershed Management Division in the Department of Environmental Conservation that really handles most of the flood resilience work. But just as we've kind of warned people in the past when we have flooding conditions, all eyes are down in the river valleys. But as soon as those flood levels start to recede a bit, attention starts to shift to the hillsides. And, you know, right now, you know, the snow is melting rapidly. We're starting to see some rains show up and steeper slopes can become really unstable under saturated soil conditions. So this is when we start to see a whole lot more action in this realm.
Hmm. And when people are calling you, what are they calling about? Are they asking for help or calling to report some of these conditions?
Both. We commonly get calls from the public and from municipalities and from local fire departments with concerns or with questions. People might start to see things changing in their backyards and not really know how to interpret those things or how to understand whether or not there's some risk involved with them. So typically we'll get a phone call or an email and then we'll just request a quick follow-up with some photographs of what people are seeing on the ground. We'll have a quick phone conversation to get some details about it. And then we do a little bit of sort of desktop reconnaissance work where we'll look at the geologic maps that we have on hand. We've, you know, as a division in the DEC, we make the geologic maps that are
and that's the Department of Environmental Conservation.
Yes, thank you. These geologic maps are used for many different things, but the geology really determines the sort of baseline hazards. So we'll look at what the bedrock is there. We'll look at what the surficial geology is there, which is on hand from prior work. And
what
then
was that? Surficial?
Surficial. I'm sorry. Yes, I'm using lots of jargon. It's just the stuff on top of bedrock, our soils and this dirt and the mud that we're talking about that's on top of bedrock.
Gotcha.
And so that way, when we arrive on site, we're not, you know, parachuting in blind. We know a little bit about it. And then and we'll try to support folks by doing an assessment. It's very site specific, but generally we're looking for indicators of slope failure, such as cracks in the soils or gaps between soils and building foundations. Sometimes there's even cracks in foundations that are fresh and that folks hadn't noticed before. Trees can be your best friend in understanding what a slope is doing. They could be leaning either into a slope or away from a slope. And if there's some obvious changes, we'll also look for infrastructure that might have been compromising a slope, such as failed drainage pipes or culverts that are not properly conveying water.
Mm. Those pesky culverts. They came up a lot in our recent show on beavers, too.
Yeah. I bet they did.
Let's go to the phones here. We have Rick calling in from East Montpelier. Rick, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, thank you. I've been through over 50 mud seasons here, and it's really – the roads have actually improved a lot because the towns have been really conscientious about – putting down new gravel, which is basically crushed granite or crushed slate. And so it's far superior to the clay loam that he was talking about. But what the real problem is the fact that when water freezes, it expands. So it's pushing all those particles apart. And the road in the wintertime is often as much as a foot higher than it is in the summertime. And so that's all got to settle back down again when it starts to thaw out. And rain is actually a good thing because it helps to settle that down. And even though it's kind of sloppy, it makes the road firmer.
Hmm.
If you have a bright, sunny day in the 60s, the road will really go downhill fast and become a real soup mess.
Mm. So, Rick, you're saying I should hope for rain right now. That's going to be hard for me to do. But I hear you. Ben, what are your thoughts there on what Rick's saying about how roads need to settle this time of year?
Yeah, I would agree actually with that. You know, when the sun pops out and you have this really rapid warming, you have to remember this frozen layer has been, you know, that layer has been getting deeper and deeper all winter. And that frost depth just continues to creep, especially in a winter like this, where we've had really lovely skiing conditions since early January without much of a thaw. It's getting really, really deep. And then if we just flash thaw this full, you know, depth of frozen soils and road conditions, you got a pretty, pretty thick section of sloppy, greasy materials. So I think the rate at which we thaw the roads is really important. And if you do it too fast, it's going to be a whole lot worse.
Sloppy, greasy materials doesn't sound good. Let's bring in one more voice to this conversation. Paul Bierman is a geology professor at the University of Vermont, as well as an author. Paul, thanks for calling in.
Sure. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Yeah. As I understand it, you have worked together before, in part on the landslide risks in Burlington around Riverside Drive. It's an area you walk a lot. Can you describe it for us?
Sure. It's a major commercial and transportation roadway in Burlington that separates, runs right along the boundary of Burlington and Winooski, and on top of a river terrace that looks down on the Winooski. It's actually really quite a pretty place. But it's also a place that's been heavily impacted by humans since about 1930. And their biggest impact was actually to dump a lot of waste. That could be soil, excavating waste, garbage, automobiles over the edge to extend the land.
So automobiles.
Land. Automobiles. 300 and some automobiles were put in a big landslide hole in the late 1950s there to save the slope.
Okay, so all right, so there's been efforts to try to save it for a while, but it sounds like it's still at high risk of a landslide.
It's at really high risk, and I think, you know, it was really good to hear Ben talk about the underlying geology that makes parts of Vermont unstable. In this case, it's actually people that have done the dirty work by trying to expand that land and put buildings on it. The material they put in turned out to be quite unstable. And so when we get a couple inches of rain here, my first thing to do is to worry. And the next thing is to either take a walk or hop in my car and look and see if that slope has failed again, which it did in a very heavy October rainstorm back just before COVID. And I'm sort of waiting, sadly, to think it's going to happen again. Many of the buildings there are tilted. The parking lots are disturbed, might be the best way to put it. There's some ground cracks. It's a place waiting to landslide.
And there are some businesses there, as well as some homes and apartments. Ben, for a place like this, like Riverside in Burlington, what can be done if you know, like we do with Riverside, that there's a very high likelihood of a landslide coming?
Well, first of all, I just need to say that waiting to landslide is going to be a new part of my lexicon. I love that you just turned that into a verb. You know, really, at the end of the day, we need to remove the exposure to the hazards. And we're trying to do that. Paul and I have sounded the alarm on several parcels along Riverside that really shouldn't have been built there in the first place. And we're supporting an effort to remove a couple of those, particularly where we already see some very obvious risk to the folks who live and work and play there. So, you know, I think the biggest part of this is educating the folks who are there, making sure they understand the hazards, and then finding ways that we can get them out of those hazardous areas.
Paul, go ahead.
I'd add one more piece to that, which I think is really important for Vermonters. You know, and there's a long tradition of using riverbanks as places to dump extra wood, trees, soil, whatever, is that it really makes for unstable slopes. And because we put that material on, it's not well compacted or pushed together, doesn't hold together well, and all it takes is a little bit of rain. So I guess my plea to people listening would be not to dump stuff over the edge, to find another place to put it, because once those landslides start, they can work their way back into the natural materials, and that can be really damaging.
A question for both of you. Paul, we'll start with you. Are there ways in which somebody might be able to, just as an individual, help remediate a landscape that might be prone to landslides? Maybe they're a property owner, for example.
Sure. You know, the best thing I have to say is leave it alone. And the second best thing is let the trees grow up on it. Those trees have deep roots in Vermont. They tie the slopes together. Forested slopes here tend not to fail as frequently as slopes that are deforested. So if you can keep the trees on and keep away from it and keep stuff off the top and not dump anything on it, you give yourself a much better chance of having a stable slope.
Mm. And Ben?
I completely agree. The only thing I would add to that is, to whatever extent possible, just usher any excess water away from those slopes. We had an example last year in St. Johnsbury that a slope was perfectly stable for many, many decades. And then right before that July storm of 2024, they happened to take the gutters off of their roof to do some painting of trim, and that slope failed. So even something as little as controlling the runoff off of your roof can make a really big difference.
Ben, are there parts of the state, like larger geographic areas, besides just a specific road or hillside, that are more prone to landslides in spring and summer?
We've been asking ourselves that a lot over the last couple of years, really since July 2023. We've learned just how susceptible a large swath of Vermont can be to failing slopes. And while we would really like to pin it to like one geography or to one certain type of geology, the fact of the matter is, when you put up to 8 inches of rain over over a watershed in the state of Vermont, you can see a lot of failing slopes. This could be on native sands from old lake beds that we used to have here that we hosted in our valleys. It could be in really, really tight glacial materials, right, that were pressed down by 2 miles of ice overhead. And like Paul said, unfortunately, in a lot of places where people have built out slopes with artificial materials. So the short answer is no, I'm not going to commit to any one part of the state that has a higher level of risk. Other than, of course, where you have steep slopes, you automatically have elevated risks.
Mm. Paul, you were last on Vermont Edition to discuss your book, When the Ice Is Gone, about Greenland's ice sheet and when it last melted and what it could teach us about climate change today. In what ways do you see climate change affecting mud season every year?
Mud season. Well, a couple things. I would say climate change is affecting mud season by changing the mud season. We got lucky this year. We had an 8-week stretch with no thaws. But my experience of the last 10 years having a camp up in the Northeast Kingdom is it kept thawing in the middle of winter, and we'd get 3 days of mud season in January and another 5 days in February, and it would come back again in March. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that as we get these thaws. But I think the other way that climate change is really going to affect us, and Ben's alluded to this, is we are having record-setting rainfall after record-setting rainfall. And often people think about that in terms of flooding in the lowlands, but it's also going to trip off these landslides, both in the summer with big thunderstorms, but also large storms in the fall. That the ground only cares about how saturated it is, if it's going to fail, how much water is in there. So as we get more rainfall, and we're about 20% more annual precip in Vermont than we were 100 years ago right now, as we get more rainfall, we're going to get more landslides here. So climate change is a big driver of our slope instability, right up there with people dumping things over the edge, and as Ben said, people changing drainage. So the best way to avoid these hazards, don't live in the floodplain and don't build a house next to a steep slope.
Oh, well, I know easier said than done for some of us, but it sounds like the state is and our neighbors are working quickly as they can to try to make the state less susceptible to flooding and to the landslides we've been discussing today. I'd love if we could end here on a positive note and a look ahead to the weeks of mud season we still get to experience together. I wonder if each of you could share your favorite mud season activity with us for the list we're compiling today. Ben, we'll start with you.
I am so cliche. I have 182 buckets hanging in my yard. So I survived the season by boiling sap and making syrup with lots and lots of kiddos running around the yard.
It's a great way to do it. And Paul?
You know, I would have said the same as going to visit sugar houses because we live in the city and don't have any buckets. And it's memories of my kids knee deep in mud when they were about five.
Oh, Paul Bierman of the University of Vermont. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure thing.
We're also joined by Vermont State Geologist Ben DeYoung. Ben, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Have a great day.
All right, we have to take one more quick break here, but when we come back, we are going to hit the muddy trails with the Green Mountain Club. We also still need your help in coming up with a list of mud season activities. Call in and tell us how you enjoy this season at 800-639-2211 or email vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. We'll be back in just a minute. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. If you're just joining us, we are discussing the highs and lows of mud season. On Vermont Public's Instagram, we asked for your favorite and least favorite parts of this time of year. Let's start with the good stuff. A lot of you said that you actually love the mud. Many people wrote that they love the smell this time of year, including the smell of the air. And one person wrote, even when it's sort of stinky, it's a sign of spring. Others love the crocus blossoms. And one person said that mud season is full of anticipation, knowing spring is almost here. And lastly, one person said that they just love not needing all their snow gear. And we'll tell you some of people's least favorite parts in just a moment. But first, our next guest is somebody who knows exactly how to enjoy this time of year and stay safe while doing it. Keegan Tierney is the Green Mountain Club's Director of Field Programs. Keegan, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Keegan, not only do you talk the mud season talk, but you walk the mud season walk quite literally. You are on a hike with your team right now. Where are you guys?
Yeah, it's true. We actually made the choice to come up to Burlington today, and we're walking the Burlington bike path, enjoying the waterfront and enjoying some of that, you know, pavement that we have that still gets us outside.
Mm. Did you have other plans that were scuttled because of the mud?
Not really. We knew we were scheduling this at a tough time of year. And so, you know, 3 weeks ago, we were looking at the weather and trying to decide, you know, what's it going to do, but it's the time of year where you really just have to make that call the day of and enjoy what you can.
Yeah, be flexible. And I'm glad you got some sun to go with your walk today. So before we get to some of your favorite hiking trails for this time of year, can you tell us a little bit more about the Green Mountain Club, what exactly it is you all do?
Sure. Yeah, the Green Mountain Club is a 100-plus-year-old organization that was founded around the concept of building a trail the length of the state of Vermont. And did that starting in 1910, and we've been managing the long trail and all of its side trails since that time, working closely with our land management partners at Forest Parks and Recreation in the northern part of the state and on the Green Mountain National Forest in the southern part of the state.
Hmm. And I hear you all have a new visitor center that just opened?
It's true, yes. We just opened up. It's at our office location in Waterbury Center. And it's a place where folks can come out if you're new to hiking and kind of learn about how to get out there in the backcountry, be safe, learn about some of the options that are available. Or even if you're old hat and want to come in, learn more about the long trail system or some of the history of the club. It's there for all types, and we have staff there to assist folks when they come in.
Hmm. So how can people figure out what trails are open and safe for hiking right now?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of great options. One, you can check out our website. We try to keep up not only with the long trail system, but with other trail systems around the state. There's another website called Trail Finder, which folks can Google, and it's managed in partnership with the Department of Forest Parks and Recreation. And you'll find all types of trails there, not just hiking trails, but water trails, bike trails, horse trails. And they have current conditions updated by the trail managers on that website.
Well, we asked folks to call in with their favorite parts of mud season, and we have Nancy on the line in Morrisville right now. Nancy, go ahead.
Hi. I was saying the best part of mud season is to start growing my vegetables and flower seeds inside, and my basin fills with foliage by the end of mud season.
Oh, wow. You don't even need to go on a hike to see some foliage right now. Can I ask, before I let you go, Nancy, what's the one thing that you are planting indoors right now that you're most excited about to eventually harvest?
Leeks are what I start with every year.
Leeks. I love it. Get some good leek soup out of that one eventually. Nancy, thank you for calling in. Keegan, you live in Starksboro in Addison County. What are your favorite places in your part of our region to go hiking?
I would say, at this time of year, what I really love to do is to get out closer to the lake and enjoy some of the wetland areas. I really enjoy watching the birds come back. So it's less of a hike and more of a wander around some of those areas. You know, Dead Creek Wildlife Management Area is one where you can just go out, take a short walk, and really, for me, see the birds coming back, but also enjoy a lot of the, you know, early vegetation that's starting to spring up.
Mm. And as you're thinking about places to go hiking over the next couple weeks during this muddy time of year, what do you look for in a place to go? Are there, you know, certain regions or certain topographies that might be better than others?
Yep. Yeah, definitely. Good things to keep in mind are our soil drainage. You know, just as some of your previous guests were talking about, the soils can really make a difference in how things firm up and how quickly things dry up at this time of year. So places on gravel or sandy soils tend to dry out sooner. And then obviously elevation is another key factor. So, this early in the season, starting lower in the Champlain Valley, you're going to find things that are much drier earlier in the season. And then they dry out progressively heading up the hills in elevation. So looking at places that may have town trail systems, municipal trail systems, the trail around Middlebury is a good example that'll dry up earlier than a lot of other trail systems. And then again, just keeping in mind to check in with those trail managers to make sure that you're aware of what restrictions or limitations they may have on their trails.
Mm. Well, as I mentioned earlier, ahead of today's show, we posted on Vermont Public's Instagram asking folks to write us with their favorite and least favorite parts of mud season. And I wanted to share a couple of folks' least favorite parts now. People said the mud, obviously. One person said dirty dog paws, muddy sneakers, mud inside the car, being terrified of getting stuck going up a muddy hill, and how there's no good way to check out road conditions ahead of a drive. A number of people brought up driving, saying that it's the worst part of mud season. And another person wrote basement flooding. When you think about mud season and some of the challenges, I know you all try to keep people safe when they're on the trails, Keegan. Is there anything you think in particular to mud season that people should be sure to like bring with them when they go hiking or be sure to think about before they hit the trails in order to stay safe?
For sure. Yeah. I don't think it changes a lot from the other seasons that we have, but yeah. A good awareness during mud season is that, you know, it may be nice and warm where I am today in Burlington. But as you head up the hills, you may be getting right back into winter conditions. So making sure you're prepared with proper layers, proper gear for the conditions you might be getting into. And then checking in, you know, if you have that time beforehand, just checking in on the weather conditions, especially in the mountains, because things can change so quickly. Outside of that, you know, in cold weather, folks tend to not feel the need to drink as much, but remembering to take water with you, stay hydrated. Take snacks with you so that you got the energy to get back out of the woods and know that you're burning more energy on these cooler days.
Mm, all good tips. We have Bard calling in from Huntington now. Bard, what is your favorite or least favorite part of mud season?
Actually, our neighborhood, years ago, we had a horrific mud season in which we were all kind of trapped here. And so what we did is we did a progressive brunch and we've been doing it now for at least 20 years. And what we do is we celebrate mud season by going to each other's houses and eating great food and visiting. So that's, we've made it into an occasion.
Do you walk from house to house? Are you able to do that?
We do. And what we try to do is make the walk appreciable. So in Huntington, it's all very hilly, so we're walking up and down the hills to each other's homes.
Mm, so you're earning your breakfast brunch. I love that. Barb, thank you so much for calling in and telling us about that. Keegan, I wonder if you have any mud season traditions or favorite ways to enjoy this time of year.
I'm a sugarer, so sugaring is my mud season activity. I also just enjoy the forced slowdown that Mother Nature puts upon us and taking the time to remember that it's, you know, it's okay to do that. It's okay to slow the pace of life down a little bit and, you know, let the world kind of dictate our pace to some extent. Mm.
Are there ways in which you are seeing signs of spring crop up, either on the walk you're on right now on Burlington's bike path or on other hikes you've taken recently?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I think I heard my first red-winged blackbird about a week and a half ago. You know, so some of those birds coming back and then seeing lots of the early flowers starting to pop up through the soil. And even out in the woods, you know, there's still a fair amount of snow in some spots, but as it recedes away, that early greenery that starts to come out and, you know, reminds us that summer's almost here.
Mm. Keegan Tierney is the Green Mountain Club's Director of Field Programs. Keegan, actually, before I let you go, just remind us, where can folks find more information about the Green Mountain Club and some of the trails that you all recommend for this time of year?
Sure, yeah. Visit our website, greenmountainclub.org, and also find Trail Finder on the Google.
All right, Keegan, well, enjoy the rest of your walk with your team. I'm a little jealous. That sounds pretty nice. We'll have to get outside soon ourselves as well. Take care.
Thank you.
I want to close today's conversation about mud season with one last comment from Vermont Public's Instagram. You can find it at Vermont Public. One person wrote to us to tell us that they had an interesting epiphany about mud season this time of year. They wrote, "We have to go through it to get to spring, so we might as well just deal." This person says that they are a mailman, so they're on the roads a whole heck of a lot. I like that. We might as well just deal or drink some maple syrup while we're at it, too. If you have other thoughts about ways that people in our region can enjoy mud season, you can email them to us still at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. We'll be compiling a list and putting it up on our website after today's show. I also want to let you know about tomorrow's Vermont Edition, because we're going to be covering a lot, and we would love to hear your input here on what we should talk about. Now, as you might be aware, state lawmakers in Montpelier are about halfway through their legislative session. Crossover day just happened. And that means we know which bills have a chance of actually becoming law. So on the next Vermont Edition tomorrow, we're going to be joined by our State House reporter, Pete Hirschfeld, and he's going to catch us up on lawmakers' progress on issues like the motel housing program, lowering the state's greenhouse gas emissions, housing and infrastructure projects, more things like that. And we want to know, what laws have you been hearing about, or bills, excuse me, have you been hearing about over the last couple months that you're curious to hear more about? You want to know what's actually happening in Montpelier. Our reporter, Pete Hirschfeld, has been following this all really closely. He's in the State House almost every single day, and he can provide us an update. But we want to make sure we're talking about the things that you and your community care about. So if it's schools this year, or climate change, or housing for folks across our region, just shoot us an email. Let us know what you're thinking. VermontEdition@vermontpublic.org is the place to do that. And after our conversation on Crossover Day, we are going to have a conversation with an award-winning children's book author and illustrator, Jason Chin. He's won a Caldecott Medal. He lives in Chittenden County, and he has a new book coming out. So whether you're in it for Crossover Day or Kids Lit, be sure to join us tomorrow on Vermont Edition. All right, that is it from me. You've heard my voice enough. Time to get outside, hit the trails like we were hearing about earlier today. Our show was directed by Aaliyah Papes. Our managing producer is John Ahrens, and our producers are Andrea Lorien and Daniela Fierro. Anna Berg is our intern, and our call screener today was Rick Barrett. Our theme music was composed by Myra Flynn. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Thank you so much for listening, and we will catch up again soon.